Cool. Yes?
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you want to play a song?
Sure.
Yes,
I do. Thanks.
Can you feel this from a distance? What I'm doing with my pins? Pull them from between my lips, and one by one I stick them in. Not a cushion, not a pillow, but a clever mannequin. If I covered it with kisses, would you feel them on your skin?
I can feel you out there doing it yet again. Up to your old tricks, dear, reaching out thin air, uncontrolled twitches, sharp pain in my back, butterfly kisses, hot breath on my neck.
Can you feel this from a distance?
It's
what I'm doing with my pins
yet again.
Up
to your old tricks, dear, reaching out thin air,
uncontrolled
twitches,
but a clever
sharp
mannequin
in my back,
butterfly kisses,
hot breath on my
neck. It's not the same as the real thing. I like this better instead.
Time. All the candles were extinguished when you put your hand in mine. The table started rocking and you caught my evil eye. We promised when we parted we would never say goodbye.
I knew from your demeanor that you were a kindred
effigy.
Your smile was so familiar,
token,
and I couldn't
something
let
that
you go.
Comes from
it's
me.
A sympathetic magic pulls us together close.
Are we cursed?
It's a sympathetic magic. It's the thing I love the most. It's not the same as the real thing.
String
and a piece
that you toss to the floor.
Just
what you wish for,
such a sweet
it comes back
control.
Sevenfold.
I
fall into a well,
pistol,
dear, and they'd never find the hole.
Better instead. Ooh, I know you're are connected. We are connected.
I want to scream and shout, but I don't have the potency of an audience, so...
Sure you do.
You're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. We just heard Sympathetic Magic from Charming Disaster, and Elia and Jeff are in the studio today, and we're just going to have a wonderful time, and I'm excited. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us. We're already having a wonderful time.
Yeah, I made you come early because I do that. And we're experimenting with something new, which I'll get into in just a moment. But first of all, I want to talk about your Kickstarter, which has been funded, and now you're getting more, and that's so exciting, and your new album. Do you want to talk about this, talk about the process?
Sure.
Yeah, it's been really overwhelming, the generosity that we've experienced with the support from the Kickstarter and the community that we've kind of reached out to.
Yeah. So just by way of context, this is our Kickstarter for our second album. Mm-hmm. And our first album, we had a song on Welcome to Night Vale, so we reached a much wider audience than we would have otherwise, which has been really great. And what we weren't expecting is that this Kickstarter would kind of do the same thing. We've managed to connect with new audience through it, not just the people who already like our music. And so we've gotten to connect with some new folks. We've been seeing, like, new sales on our Bandcamp because people like find the Kickstarter and support it, and then they're like, oh, like there's already some music we can buy, and then they've been getting that, and it's a lot of our stuff is by donation or like pay what you want, and so it's like it's so special to see people paying when they don't have to, and it means a lot to us. I mean, it helps us fund the machine, but also like really makes us feel good.
Yeah, absolutely. The community, like, I think going out on a limb and being like, I hope this can happen, and then having the community show up is like, I was excited to watch that process. And I was thinking this morning about you, Elia, because we met just over a year ago. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about how different your life is now than it was then. Excuse me, I'm recovering from a cold. I don't know if you guys have gotten it. It's been going around, but I'm better. Just sound sick. So I was thinking about your life a year ago and today. Jeff, has your life changed similarly, or
in the past year?
Yeah,
definitely. In the past, I mean, it's been maybe less marked as Ellie's because of her, you know, not working.
I quit my day job.
That's what I was mostly referring to.
But I've definitely spent more time away from my day job, and the kind of intensity that's happened in the past year, I think, has definitely it's ramped up. You know, it's been a process over these past 4 years since we've been working together, but in the last year, it's definitely feel like the pitch is higher.
Yeah, you guys are doing things, making these happening, investing more time. You have an intern.
We have an intern.
Isn't that the like mark of success?
Well,
it feels like
both like a marker and something that will help us achieve it. Like there have been a lot of positive feedback loops. And I was thinking about the intern thing today. So her name is Taylor, and she is wonderful. She's a fan of ours and a friend of my best friend from college. And she got into her music when we were on tour in Norfolk, Virginia, where she lives. and we asked her if she would be interested in helping us out with some stuff, mainly social media stuff. And she has joined our team. She has her own email address. It's artichoke@charmingdisaster.com. We have a song about an artichoke. So it's been really great in a lot of ways, partly because it makes us articulate our process a lot more in order to have somebody else be able to do things. And I was thinking about it because our songwriting process also is a little like that as well. Like, I feel like as a songwriter, I've learned to articulate what it is that I'm doing because Jeff and I have been working together so collaboratively for the last 4 years. I'm doing a songwriting workshop. I'm teaching one in a few weeks. And a lot of the things that I articulate in the workshop are things that have arisen because of working
like developing your process.
Yeah. So the intern thing is similar.
And I really love stories of meetings. How did you guys meet? How did Charming Disaster come to be?
We met in a bar. My other band was playing, which is a larger band. There's horns and drums and bass and strings. And we were playing at Barbez in Park Slope in Brooklyn, and we played, and Elia came up to me afterwards, and she was, you know, we were talking, and she mentioned that she has a band with a similar lineup, and she described it, and I was like, oh, that sounds great, you know, and I'm always looking to, you know, share bills and trying to get more gigs for the band, so I said, oh, yeah, we should share a bill, and she's like, yeah, could do that, or we should write songs together, and I was like, what? Okay, I'd never done that before with anyone, and I thought, okay, yes, that sounds right. We should write songs together.
I feel like I should interject something, which Go, is that please. Well, so I was a little drunk. Well, I'd had like a beer, and I was feeling expansive. But I came into the bar kind of at random because I lived in the neighborhood, mm-hmm. and I accidentally caught Coda Reno, and I felt watching Coda Reno and watching Jeff in particular, I felt like, oh, I get what he's doing. Like, I get what this band is doing. And, like, I feel like we speak the same language as songwriters. Like, I really liked mm-hmm. the way that the songs were written. And so when I spoke to you afterwards, it really was this feeling of, like, kindred spirits. But, like, I was not somebody who, like, wrote songs with people or, like, went around offering to write songs with people. But, like I said, I'd had one beer and I'm kind of a lightweight. And so I was like, oh, yeah, like, we should write songs together. But then we did. And we did.
And
we almost immediately, well, then my band, Sweet Soubrette, played a show the next week and Jeff came to see that and then I think had a similar kind of experience.
Yeah, it made sense.
And so we had a meeting, like, the next day. And that was when we started writing Ghost Story. Like, we made a list of things to write songs about as like a two-voice operation, like two narrative voices as well as two literal voices. And the, like, top three things on the list were two people have murdered someone and they don't know what to do, and a living person in love with a ghost.
Correct.
Those are the first two we thought of. So that, and those were, became Murderer and Ghost Story.
Yeah, we sat down and kind of defined the parameters, which... I think with, at least with my own band, there are very few parameters as far as, you know, that are predefined. They're kind of self-defining parameters, which happens with personnel and people and instrumentation. But the fact that we had this idea at the beginning was, you know, to have duets and from the perspective of two different people. And man and woman specifically.
Yeah, it was very on purpose. Like, I've never had a project that was so on purpose either.
Yeah.
And it's really helped us a lot. And, like, you know, and it's evolved. And certainly not every single one of our songs is exactly that. There are some that, like, one of us brings in and then we kind of develop. And the two-voice thing kind of evolves organically. But it gives us such a useful framework to build off of that we've been very prolific.
Yeah, that's something in exploring the creative process, it seems like sometimes limiting things expand them.
Yeah, often. Yeah.
And so just by creating a container, then you're able to, like, fill it, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to put it.
And we had never worked together before, and, you know, to have some kind of parameter to work with, and you can kind of hide behind that a little bit. I think there was a little bit of that. And also the other thing that we said is, like, they can be bad.
They can be bad.
Did you get that from Susan?
Well,
I think it's a universal thing too, of, like, you have to be
really
comfortable
important.
Making shitty art.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, like, and not every single song that we've written together has been successful. Like, we have a sort of, like, I don't know, there's some sports metaphor, the bench. There's some, like, bench warmer songs.
Yeah.
I don't really speak sports metaphor
bench.
Fluently.
I get it.
Yeah.
You know, and there's
a parlor. They sit in the parlor.
Yeah, even if you don't play sports, you know what the bench is for.
There's that one about euthanasia.
Euthanasia.
Ooh.
And there's the one about the robots that we never really finished.
Yeah, the end of the world.
Yeah.
Robots taking over.
We have good ideas, but they don't all get, like, executed in a way that is compelling.
But we allow them to... You know, we get the idea and we kind of follow it.
To the end. And, like, there are some really great things about working collaboratively. Like, so, and our process has really evolved over the last 4 years also. Like, we began in a sort of epistolary style where one of us would begin a song and then, you know, we would record, like, a verse and a chorus or something and then send an email with the lyrics. And Ghost Story was written like that.
So that makes me ask, how much of your process ends up being digital and how much ends up being face-to-face?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, I would say that when we started, it was very much we were kind of working in our own corners and writing each other letters. Yeah. And then we'd get together and, like, practice how to do them.
Right.
But now... Now, it's like...
There's a little bit of kind of working together. That has developed more when we sit side by side and kind of in the moment come up with stuff, which is...
Yeah. Being able to go into that sort of flow zone place with somebody feels like a really rare thing.
Yeah.
And, like, I would say, like, we started out with sort of, like, separate corners epistolary thing, and then it became more like a storyboarding process where, like, we'd get together and we'd talk at length about, like, well, what happens next, or, like, why would that happen?
And
or...
I imagine doing research in history and real stories, because a lot of your songs are rooted in, like, actual things that happened, or, you know, are spin-offs of...
That is true. Yeah. And but the thing that's happened that sort of surprised me, at least, is that we've gotten to a place where we can sit next to each other and not just do the sort of background research storyboard work together, but actually, like, come up with ideas in the moment and, like, work them in the moment.
Yeah.
And that we've done that on tour a bit. Like, we've done that while we're traveling.
Yeah. And a residency.
Yeah. I was going to ask, I talked to you a little bit about the residency, but I was going to ask about that because I feel like, just to, like, in a very literal way, create the space and get rid of everything else. And, like, I mean, in a lot of things that I've done, like, you know, doula work or yoga, you're creating a safe space. And so to intentionally get out of your life, get out of your world, and, like, push all the distractions and just have this space held and then, like, see what happens. Was that a really, like, big catalyst, or was it just, like,
it was
pushing momentum?
It was kind of transformative. Yeah. I mean... I'd never so much as applied for such a thing before, and to be taken that seriously as an artist was very empowering and felt, it was liberating. It was like being given permission.
Mm-hmm. Which is silly, but sometimes all you need is someone being like, you're allowed to do that, and you're like, what?
Yeah. Well, they were very explicit, too. The residency was this organization called Crosshatch, based in Michigan. And they have this house that they make available to artists. It can house up to, like, I don't know, 4 to 6 people working collaboratively, but it's close quarters.
Yeah.
Like, you couldn't really be working on, like, totally separate stuff. It's like a kind of open plan house. But when we got there, they were like, look, you don't have to do anything or make anything while you're here. Like, this time is for you. If you want to just, like, sit and look at trees for 2 weeks, like, that is totally cool.
Yeah.
That was the thing, kind of like the freedom to make stuff that sucks, like the freedom to not produce anything and just to like think, actually made us very productive, I think.
Yeah. And also reading other people's accounts of there's a guest book that we would read. And, you know, we developed some patterns or
rituals.
Some kind of rituals, some techniques on to kind of trick ourselves into being creative, I think, or just kind of create an environment where it's, you know, we would do exercise in the morning. We would do, like, a yoga in the morning. Part of our morning ritual was to go through the guest book and read other people's kind of accounts of their time there. And there are a lot of recurring themes. A lot of it is kind of being faced with all this openness and
time
and space, what do you do with it?
A little, it's like the blank page. It's just like there, and you're like, okay, now what?
And it's funny because it's like, it's not different from the rest of your, like, it's just, it's a sort of concentrated version of your life, because you're like, oh my God, I just have this time, and it's so short, and it's so precious, and, like, how am I going to spend it? And, like, what is the most, like, worthwhile way to spend it? Which is, like, a question you can absolutely apply to your life as a whole, but when it's boiled down to 2 weeks, it gets kind of intense.
And and you don't have the excuse of, like, oh, I don't have time,
I have work, or whatever.
I have this, all that. which right, we generate for ourselves in our lives.
Distractions. Yeah.
And then you find out how much of what you don't get done is just because of you and not because of the external stuff, which can be pretty sobering.
Yeah.
And then there's this evolution that happens that we sort of saw in the guest book entries too, where you kind of start to read, you're like, well, what does it mean to be productive? Like mm-hmm. how do you best use the time?
Sitting and
life?
Staring at trees for 2 weeks might be
out,
the best productivity.
Exactly.
Yeah. We went snowshoeing a few times while we were there. There were snowshoes in the garage and it was all like snow covered woods. And like that's a memory that I will carry with me always, is like walking through those woods and hearing the crack of the branches and the stuff dripping. And then we'd go into the cabin and we would write songs, and like mm-hmm. that was really cool. And I would say that was like the most like intense time of getting into that flow place together.
Yeah, side by side kind of
because
writing.
We never get that kind of time, you know? And like you can be like, all right, like today we're gonna work on this thing and we're gonna sit here on the couch until we feel like we're done. And then mm-hmm. like 6 hours later we're like, all right, like let's cook some dinner.
Yeah. Full-time creativity.
And the cooking aspect was also part of it as well. That there's obviously a creative aspect to cooking mm-hmm. and sustenance and the sustaining aspect that, you know, is metaphorically perfect for a retreat like that. And that was something we had a problem to solve. We were like, all right, we have this squash, this onion, and a can of tomatoes, and
a thing of ricotta cheese.
That's one of my secret pleasures about things like co-ops or like food things. Like, here's this box of food, and you're like, what is this vegetable? Oh, it's a fruit.
it's like a puzzle.
Like, how do you do it?
Right. Yeah. There's also a lot of people who do this particular residency are solo practitioners. And so there's like a recipe book that people have made over the years also. And a lot of them are like cornbread for one
cooking for yourself is.
Yeah. With two people, it wasn't so bad because we could make like a normal amount and then we'd have leftovers for lunch. And we kind of got into a routine with that too.
Yeah.
There was a piano. Mm-hmm. And there was just all the stuff that you would need. There was a piano, mm-hmm. and there were
internet and cell service?
There was internet. Cell service was a little spotty, but there was Wi-Fi at the house.
Yeah.
That's something. I went to Vermont 2 weekends ago now, last weekend. My sense of time is not ever to be trusted.
Before
mm-hmm. this moment, I was in Vermont, and my phone, no service, and I was getting anxious because I felt like there's things I would be needing to respond to. But then it was nice to just like
not be able to
be like, well, I really can't.
Yeah.
There's nothing you can do.
Do that. And then, you know, take some time for that plugged in part of my mm-hmm. brain to unwind. But to like forcibly unplugged was a nice.
Yeah. It's really hard to do that. We kind of like tried to limit it, you know, to like,
I thought we did,
right? Like checking email like once or twice a day and like, you know, that's it. But I had an outgoing, you know, one of those like auto reply things set up on my email mm-hmm. that was like, look, I'm gone for this time. Like I might not be able to get back to you until I get back. And I was talking about this with my brother the other day. He was like, I feel like I need to have one of those vacation autoresponders
all the time.
That's mm-hmm. just like for when things are just too much.
I used to have this recording on my answering machine because voicemail, like, I don't leave me a voicemail. I probably won't listen to it. But it was like, I'll call you back when I get, like, when I feel like it. I mean, when I get the time. Just like, ask my dad. You call me and like maybe a month later I'll actually like get back to you. I'm the worst. Anyways. So we tried something new this week with my river writing practice portion, in that we did it before the show. So for listeners, I don't think I'm even going to read the poem, but I will tell you what it is, and I'll include a link in the show notes. I have to find it again. It was a little strange and dark. I read it in text form, but then listening to it was like,
it was powerful. I loved it.
I did too,
I loved his reading it.
Yeah, and there's like a not too distracting graphic aspect mm-hmm. to the video. So
very musical. yeah. musically read.
Yeah, so the poem that we were using this week is called Prayer Before Birth by Lewis McNeice. And again, I'll include a link. And I'm wondering if either of you would like to read what we wrote, that short 3-minute free write.
Sure.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You want to go first?
Sure. If I can read my handwriting.
I know.
It was just free writing. Let's see. I wrote, the play of the dream of a life, the life in a stream after the fall, after there was an after. The ability to age, move, love, want, kill. The after it all, the after that the before could never be. The awareness of evil, good, and the marbleized non-distinctions. Is there a good, a bad, or just a potential fighting to be active? Activity? ? The stream of being, the joy of pain, of existence. What do we know but fear of non-existence? The dream together yet alone within the result. Whatever that means.
Thank you.
Sure.
Elliot, do you want to read it?
Sure.
Yes. You don't have to read, but I'm always like mini party when people say yes.
First, breathing in and out to fix the self in the moment here in the basement of a Brooklyn row house, rocked by the rhythms of the palm just read us like a prophecy. Mm-hmm. Visions of tiny babies swimming in the dark, planted like seeds in my best friends next to me but not in me. And better not to, given the terrible future, the terrifying, luxurious present. Breathe in, breathe out. Be here in the basement. Recall the flood of words, the litany, the blood-sucking bat and the stoat and the water in hands cupped, the huge eye in the huge head and the tiny body swimming in the velvet dark like a possible future. Breathe in, breathe out. Dandle, words of sky and light, trees and birds, elemental things that may remain after the known world is blown to kingdom come, the kingdom that may come. Future, breathe out, breathe in. Here in the basement now.
Thank you. That was wonderful. Mine, for some reason, this makes me think of the Bible being like a child. Children have this hardiness and moldability and yet carry with them so much vulnerability, the trauma of being rejected or abandoned to any degree. I have a memory at the pool. I yelled to my mom, "Watch me!" as so many kids have done, and as I leapt into the air, and then watched as fear moved across her face. I'm calculating. I realize I've just jumped into deep water as my toes break the surface, and I feel the coolness move up my legs, up, up, over my head. I keep going down, down, down into that blue. My feet touch something solid. I crouch, then launch myself upward, gasp, descend, push, breathe. I do this 5 times before my brother grabs me and pulls me to the safety of the edge. Great. Thank you for doing that. If you're just tuning in, that was a Seated in Poetry river writing exercise, and I'll include a link if you want a writing prompt. And you're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn, broadcasting out of Bushwick. And we're here with Charming Disaster, talking about all kinds of things and generally having fun. Yes. I hope.
Yes.
Definitely.
Let me see what I have as talking.
We were going to talk about books.
We were going to. Yeah. Have you encountered any good books in your life?
In my life?
Recently. Or in its entirety?
I'm reading a book right now, which is, I didn't get into it until about 200 pages in, and it's like a 600 page book. It is wonderful and heartbreaking, and it's called A Little Life.
Oh.
Which I've seen a lot of people reading.
Yeah, I've seen that around. I think I've started it a couple times, but it's imposing.
It is imposing, but I just got to the point where
now you're into it.
Crying. Yes, it is. It is intense and beautiful and heartbreaking, and I recommend it. It goes through lots of things, but it's a lot about self-harm and the background of that is one part of it, plus about relationships and people and friends who grew up in New York City. It's a New York City.
I have an appreciation now, like being in the city.
Yeah.
Just like things that are New York centric. You're like, yeah, I know that.
So it's got a lot of good things to it.
A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara.
Yes.
Do you know how to say that properly?
No.
Yeah, I've seen it bouncing around. It's been in my peripheral, so perhaps I'll sit down and invest the time.
Yeah, it's for heavy summer reading. But then, right before that, I read Station 11, which is a book about post-apocalyptic America after a huge flu happens, and it's about a traveling band of Shakespeare actors and symphony that kind of travel from camp to camp performing for people. And that is by someone
wrote that
someone
book.
I know, actually I met her, and she's Emily.
Would it be Emily St. John Mandel?
Yes, Emily St. John.
Station 11.
Yes, she's a Brooklynite.
Cool.
Elia, any good books?
I've been on a Margaret Atwood kick.
Oh, ooh.
I went.
You've been kicking her for a while, though.
I have, but I've been like chain smoking her the last little bit. So I went camping for a week and I brought Oryx and Creek with me.
Oh my gosh!
Immediately finished it, just like tore through it. Read most of it again. I had run out of books, and so I started it. But it holds up pretty well to an immediate second reading because like the language is so beautiful and the level of detail is so great, but like the plot is so gripping that, like, you know, I was just sort of like devouring it. And so going through it a second time and like actually taking the time to notice all the detail was kind of nice. And then I got home and I've been using my Brooklyn Public Library membership I've been using the ebook thing for a lot, and I've gotten back into like hard copy library
books. Actual books.
And I just love the like hold function.
They're
so accommodating. I'm like, can you please deliver these 8 books to the DeKalb branch? And they're like, oh sure, we'll send you an email. And like,
feel like such a celebrity walking in there?
I feel like I've discovered something that nobody else knows. Yeah. And I talk about it. I'm like, have you heard? There's this.
It's so easy.
It doesn't cost
they just
anything.
Appear.
It's like Netflix, but really slow.
So I immediately then read The Year of the Flood, which is the second book, which is so good. And then as soon as I finished that, Mad Adam had come in. And so I was able to go straight from The Year of the Flood into Mad Adam. And so I finished that, and like, I'm kind of taking a minute.
There's so much to digest.
Did you know? There's so much to digest. And like, she's so, it's so dark, and she's so funny and warm and generous.
Yeah, it's so dark.
Like, but I think I had sort of resisted reading Oryx and Creek for a long time
because
the description of it just made it seem so like such a downer, and it's like it's just such a great movie.
Well, I feel that could be said of a lot of her work, is that it's you're like, oh, it's kind of a downer, but there's this like very solid beam of light and hope that like pulls you through, and you're like,
I think it's just her own sort of gracious humanity like running through it. Like she's like, I had the opportunity to see her speak last year at the Book Riot Live conference, and like she was just so funny.
And that's why I tell people she's so sharp.
She's so sharp, and it was like being in the presence of a master. Like she had no need to prove anything to anybody, and was just able to like be generous and like tell funny stories and like answer. Somebody asked, "Well, what do you do if you're a writer and you're writing a story that's based on someone's real life who you know?" And she was like, "Well, you've got 2 options. You can change their hair color or wait until they're dead." And without even like pausing.
Yeah, that she doesn't have to think about it; just like comes out. Yeah.
Did you know that she has a new book coming out this fall? It's called Hag Seed, and it's based on The Tempest.
Ooh,
yeah.
I feel like there's been a wave of Shakespeare-inspired,
things.
I mean, there always is. He's a master, and you gotta like pull from the things that work, and like you know, there's something to be said for like making something current, but. Shakespeare. I haven't actually read a ton of Shakespeare. What is your guys' relationship with Shakespeare? Because it sounds like you just read a book that was kind of pulled from him or them.
Well, there were that repertoire. I really like The Tempest a lot. I read that a while ago, though.
I just read it. That was one of my other camping trip books.
Yeah. Yeah. I enjoyed the magic aspect of it a lot, and I like the musical spells and incantations. And then I saw the film Prospero's Books, which is Peter Greenaway's adaptation of that, with Sir John Gielgud doing the acting as Prospero.
Uh-huh.
And that is just mind-blowing in its kind of kaleidoscopic, rich colors and dense tableaus of activity and beauty and scenes of what's happening and language. And it's a lot to take in. Actually, the first time I saw it was like, I can't.
Yeah.
This is like a rich meal I can't eat right now. But it brought another layer of appreciation to the original text, and
has to happen, I feel like, for it to work.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at as far as Shakespeare's go. Like,
I want more. I just
I do enjoy Kurosawa interpretations of Shakespeare, but that's, I don't know.
How about you? Are you?
I had a great English teacher when I was a senior in high school who really made us feel a sense of, like, possession about Hamlet, like, that it belonged to us and that it was accessible to us. And, you know, we all had to, like, memorize some piece of it. And it was to be or not to be. Like, we all had to memorize that. So I still have that, which is nice.
Can pull it out. Yeah, party trick.
Or like when you're driving and you're bored, you know.
Yes, I've heard it.
We do a lot of
driving. She does a great rendition.
I've really enjoyed those sort of modern remixes of Shakespeare. I mean, that's one of the things that I kind of feel like is such a, I don't know, I feel like anything one says about Shakespeare, somebody else has already said. But the fact that those stories hold up to so many retellings.
Years and years. Like, and, yeah.
You know, in the same way that, like, you know, the stories of Greek mythology hold up to retellings and retellings and retellings. Like, there's something so elemental about those stories and those characters that they seem to be able to withstand time in a way that isn't really interesting.
Yeah. While we're talking, I had two thoughts. The first is, if you want a quick and funny exposure to Shakespeare, there's a DVD called The Complete Works of William Shakespeare Abridged by the Reduced Shakespeare Company, I think based out of UK.
I think I saw this.
Wonderful.
Show once.
I think I discovered it, and I think I very quickly had like 5 movie parties where I was like, come over, we'll watch this movie. Like, great. Everyone that's like, want to watch a movie? I'm like, yep, here it is. Like, so that's like a, you know, really humorous overview that if you know anything about Shakespeare, you'll be able to appreciate and laugh. And I love how dirty Shakespeare is.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times.
Body.
Yeah,
I appreciate that too. I'm someone who likes to know the backstory so that I understand the thing that's referring to it. Although, as a liberal arts student, often you never get the primary text, and like it's always like secondary. So I like to kind of get the background. Like, you know,
you're
like
a completionist.
I'm kind of a completist, and also like I'm a nerd, and I like to like drill down and like really get the deep knowledge. About a thing that I'm interested in, but like, well, on that point, like, we're writing, we're putting together the layout for our lyrics booklet for the new album, Cautionary Tales, and we have footnoted it extensively.
Yes,
because we're nerds.
Can appreciate a good footnote. Well, I imagine it's like a tree, and the deeper you grow roots, the more like foliage and leaves you can shoot off, and the like. Anyways, so this the second thought that I was holding from Shakespeare is this idea. I feel like there's two camps, and the first camp is there are no new ideas. Like, we're all just regurgitating archetypes, universal unconsciousness, or whatever have you. And then the other camp is like, you have to think differently, create new ideas. Do you have thoughts or opinions
on whether there are new ideas?
Yeah, new ideas, no new ideas. I guess maybe. Does being inspired by something mean it's different, or are you just redoing something?
Well, I think, at least with Shakespeare and the Greek mythology, that really touches what it's like to be a human a human being, like in what it's like to live and lose and
yeah.
feel pain and all
the
that.
The rawness of it, really, which is what you're talking about yeah. in A Little Life too. Yeah, just like it, this, like
it accesses that, and then there's context and ways of looking at that and ways of interpreting those things, which are infinitely varied, and people touch on those things all the time and show new ways to kind of appreciate what it is to be human and how we relate to any work of art. It's like, but as we develop and as our kind of context change,
yeah,
I think, you know, those ways to make those connections and what makes us human and ways to relate to one another or relate to a piece of work of art in some way or another, those change, and that kind of language changes.
Yeah, like your preferences and like the things that resonate with you change. Like you talked about the film, what was it?
Prospero's Books.
Prospero's Books, yeah.
And how it was just like, well, this is too much, but yeah. it still was like enough to yeah. like make you respond.
Yes, exactly. And yeah. to go back and look at the
yeah, revisit. Yeah.
That's my take on new ideas versus old ideas, I think.
I mean, I think it's maybe not how I sort of formulate the question when I think about it. Mm.
How would you formulate the question?
Well,
new ideas.
Well, I feel like part of the story is in the telling of the story, and so there's this transformation that happens every time a story is kind of transmitted in a new way. That is because it is this sort of relationship between the speaker and the hearer and like the story itself. Mm-hmm. Like story almost as language.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I don't know that I value novelty as such in storytelling as much as the kind of communication. I don't know. I'm not articulating it very well, but I Neil Gaiman writes a lot about like story and the mm-hmm. people's need for stories, and that stories, storytelling and stories themselves like are valuable. And I think about how much I loved fairy tales as a kid and how much those stories continue to sort of weave their way into the other work that I make, but also that they are, like, when you retell those stories, because sometimes I like to do that, just, you know, oh, like, you want to hear about the princess with the seven swan brothers? Like, mm-hmm. I'll tell you that story. But you find when you tell those stories
that,
like, there are a lot of things you don't know, and that mm-hmm. there are, and so you either fill them in and, like, make something new, or you talk about the things that you don't know, or like, just your questioning of it, like, becomes a new sort of element. I'm also a big fan of Once Upon a Time. Like, I love the way that they remix and, like, recombine those fairy tale stories. And mm-hmm. I don't know. So for me, I like the layering, and it doesn't really matter to me. Like, I don't know that I really think about whether there are new stories or not, because
yeah.
it's such a vocabulary that gets reshuffled in so many ways.
Yeah. As a writer trying to find my process, I feel like there's value in learning the archetypes, but also in not, it's not a formula, I guess, for lack of a better word. And this happened kind of in the film industry, where it's like, this is how you write a movie. And so all the screenplays started to follow this formula.
Sure.
And it's like, okay, well, it's almost like, it doesn't work at that point. Mm-hmm. But tapping into the archetypes of, like, you know, different aspects of the human psyche, there's a reason why there's so much out there about them, because they resonate. They're parts of us, the shadow self, you know, the crone, the hermit, or, you know, the child, or whatever.
Right, the uncanny child, the femme fatale, yeah.
the fool. Like, yeah, you know, yeah, all these yeah. things are parts of being human. So it's this dance of exploring the humanity without trying right. to fit it into a box, I guess yeah. you could say.
I mean, I can imagine as a writer trying to, like, find and define your voice, it's a much more urgent feeling question than as someone who kind of takes stories and works them as with clay or something. It's just,
yeah.
I think it's not, we're doing such different things that we, you know, we're kind of thinking about it differently.
Yeah.
But speaking of recombining stories or like revisiting stories, we saw Hadestown before it closed,
oh, yeah.
Which is a musical written by Anais Mitchell, who's a singer-songwriter, mm-hmm. and she retells the story of Orpheus and Eurydice in this theatrical song cycle, and like mixes in Hades and Persephone, and like they're all, four of them are these characters in this, and it was so inspiring as, you know, people who like to work with older stories.
Yeah.
It was so cool.
Great. Well, believe it or not, we've been here for 46 minutes.
What?
Well, you guys have been here for longer, but we've been talking on air for 46 minutes.
Insane.
I like to end my shows with rapid fire, which you've experienced. These can be fast questions or slow questions, but it's a series of questions, and we'll see how many we get.
You said vapid fire.
Vapid fire.
Vapid fire.
Who does your what hair? Is
that? Rapid.
Oh, rapid.
Enunciate. My first question is, I've been thinking a lot about mentors and mentorship, and you don't have to name drop, but maybe think about a mentor who's influenced your life path and just like tell me a little bit about like some themes that they taught you. Mm-hmm. So.
Oh, okay.
Ideas?
This guy, when I lived in Boston, his name was Mr. Butch. He was a homeless guy that I was kind of under his wing for a little while. He was like
local. Homeless?
No, I wasn't. Okay. I wasn't homeless. He was kind of like a, you know, like the mayor of Kenmore Square when I lived.
He was just there.
He was there all the time, uh-huh. And he was a character. And I was in his band at one point, and he really like, I had just moved up to Boston. I didn't know anything about anything. That's which is why I moved to Boston. If I'd known anything about anything, I wouldn't have moved there. But he kind of took me under his wing and like protected me and showed me this kind of world, and he had incredible intelligence and humanity about him, but you know, he was also an alcoholic and mm-hmm. He had some other problems, learning disabilities and stuff, but he really taught me a lot.
Thank you. Elia, yeah. Is there a mentor that stands out in your memory?
Yeah, for sure. Someone I still work with, Stephanie Monsu, is one of the co-founders mm-hmm. of the Mendelstift Family Circus. And that's she and her partner Keith, who has also been a mentor to me. They started the circus company from scratch. It's a DIY mom and pop kind of operation, and like it's now been around for 25 years. And I've worked with them now for a long time. And Stephanie is someone who like as a performer is so formidable, and as an organizer and inspirer of other people, like I've learned so much just by watching her on stage and how thoughtfully they do what they do, and also like how they kind of do everything. Like it's mm-hmm. it's been really inspiring for me as a performer who like wants to
do everything.
yeah
to be allowed to do that.
Yeah, and like that they kind of, you know, she really has created something that didn't exist before, and now she's doing a lot of work upstate with kids and is like writing grants, and you know, and like, which is not to say that like Keith, her partner, is not equally inspiring and has also been a mentor but she's a woman leader of her own mm-hmm. company, and as that, like that's been a real role model for me, getting to watch her do that.
Wonderful, thanks. Next question, do you have a current media addiction, so like Netflix or a podcast or
Stranger Things.
Oh my gosh, I just watched that. Have you seen it too?
Yeah, I went through that.
I haven't seen it all yet.
Oh, where are you?
What's her face just went into the tree.
Why would you go in there?
I know.
Don't go in there.
And I was watching it with my boyfriend, and I was like, we can just watch the teaser because it will tell me if she lives or dies. Uh-huh. And he was like, nope. Bedtime. And I was like, it's like the worst.
So I've also been watching with my boyfriend. He's watched ahead of me, which I'm a little mad about.
Bummer.
But he hasn't watched the last one yet. And he's like, but look, that means that like you can watch it without me if I'm like out of town. And I'm like, are you crazy? Like, I'm watching that by myself.
Great. So the answer for both of you?
Yeah, that was a good, recently.
A good answer. Mm-hmm. So you're at a party and someone's like, what's your favorite brag? What do you reply?
What's your favorite what?
Brag.
Brag?
Brag.
Like you're bragging about yourself and your life.
Oh, my favorite brag. I thought you said bread.
I thought so too.
What's your favorite bread too?
Sourdough.
Caraway
rye.
I'm trying to learn how to make my own sourdough. I've been feeding a starter for
a
while.
We have a starter if you need a...
I have a starter. Yeah. It's just actually making bread.
Yeah.
I need a finisher. How about brag with a G?
Brag.
Oh,
favorite brag. Like
show off. So, yeah, like show so my thing is I the queen of eclectic living. I like bragging about living in a treehouse and a greenhouse, my friend's unfinished basement, my car, a van.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
You know, back porches. I had a stretch where I was very creatively living in this world, homeless, if you will, which is why I'm like intrigued by, because I still had a full-time job and no one at work ever suspected. Yeah. And
wow.
I like this story of working with a photographer. And she was like, okay, so I'll email you. And I was like, okay, it might be a little while before I reply because I don't have electricity. And she's like, what? And I was like, I live in a tree. She's just like, wait, what?
Which is funny
because she was doing an art project called What I Thought I Saw, where she took pictures of people and then told their story. And like you put them together and you're like, how does that's not what I see. But anyway, so brag.
I toured with a circus.
Oh, that's a good one.
That is a good one.
And I was in a band with a homeless person.
That's a good brag too. Yeah.
Oh, we played a show at a historic cemetery last weekend.
Yeah, we played in cemeteries.
Also very cool. And you have a show coming up
at Pete's Candy Store. Pete's Candy Store. Mm-hmm. That's true. Oh, good segue. On September 20th, which is the day before our Kickstarter ends. So the Kickstarter is still going. We have funded, but we're going for some stretch goals.
Yeah.
To make the cautionary tiles even more exciting and fancy and stuff.
Supported. Yeah. It's so great. I haven't actually committed, but I have time. So do you, if you're listening.
There's time.
And then you guys are going to end with a song, and I'll let you introduce that. I do want to say you've been listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. I do need to just really quick touch base about a fundraising concert we have. You can get more information at radiofreebrooklyn.com/fundraiser, and that will be on September 10th. So coming up, all of the Radio Free Brooklyn parties are really amazing, and it's an opportunity to actually see the community that you hear and interact with people.
And the parties are great. I saw you at one.
Yeah, so random. I was like, this world is small. New York.
Small. New York is small.
Running into people.
It's a village.
And so I will leave you with the word, take it or leave it, tintinabulation.
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 I like that one.
Oh, I like that word.
Yeah. And we're about to make one.
Yes.
So speaking of songs that retell stories that are old stories, this is our take on the Orpheus and Eurydice myth. And if you're not familiar with that story, Orpheus was a musician in Greek mythology. His girlfriend, Eurydice, and she got bit by a snake and she died. And he was very sad about it. And he went down to the underworld to get her back.
Whether she liked it or not.
And that's sort of the part that we talk about in this song.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Went down into the dark black pit.
In my elbows, in her hollow snake bit.
Out your life was just a black pit.
You should have never tried to follow.
Set out with my telecaster. Charm the bouncer at the pearly gates. Was trying to avert disaster.
It was already too late. When they called me in to grant your favor, I was starting to accept my fate. You stood there like some kind of savior.
You should have been a piece of cake.
Snake bit.
Snake bit. I never learned to let go, I wept.
You sang into that black pit of doubt.
And held it open like a red rose.
I heard my favorite song.
Blood flow from my fingers. Make a path to guide you on.
But you should have let me linger.
Since you left me, I've been haunted.
Yeah, I shuffled off that mortal chain. You never asked me what I really wanted.
left me in a world of pain.
Snake bit.
Condition. You're looking back to see your face. Could have been an apparition.
Had to take it all on fake. Did you think you could just waltz in here and carry me away? I made you turn back at the final moment.
You were calling out my name.
Face it. You were left alone. Death hit.
I needed you beside.
Wasted. What's a song if no one's there who hears it?
I needed you beside me.
Snake bit.
Snake bit.
She sailed on a day over the sea.